The memory of our final deployment still haunts me. I, Brother Valerius of the Crimson Sentinels, record these words with a trembling hand, not from fear, but from the biological changes that have taken root within my physiology. The mission to Tenebris 6 began like countless others, a distress signal, an oath of duty, a promise to deliver the Emperor's judgment. None of us suspected it would end with me alone, the sole survivor of what was once the proud Third Company. Our chapter, the Crimson Sentinels, emerged during the 23rd founding, bearing the gene seed of Gilliman's sons. While we honored our ultramarine lineage, we forged our own identity as masters of void warfare. Our battle brothers trained extensively in zero-gravity combat, ship-to-ship boarding actions, and the brutal close-quarters fighting that defined such engagements. The chapter's fortress monastery orbited the feudal world of Sanctus Rubrum, a massive void station built into the hollowed remains of a captured Orc space hulk. From this mobile bastion, we patrolled the eastern fringes of Ultramar, standing vigilant against Xeno's incursions that threatened the Imperium's borders. Captain Tiberius led our company with the calculated precision expected of those who carry Gilliman's legacy. When the astropathic distress message arrived from Tenebris 6, a death world on the edge of the Ghoul Stars, he assembled our finest warriors for immediate deployment. The message itself contained disturbing fragments, garbled references to moving shadows and singing darkness, amid more conventional reports of possible Xeno's activity. Warning signs manifested before we even entered the warp. Tech priests aboard our strike cruiser, the Oath of Vengeance, reported unusual fluctuations in the Geller fields during pre-jump diagnostics. Our chapter's chief librarian requested inquisitorial support, noting that recent auger sweeps had detected warp anomalies throughout the sector. His request was denied. The Ordo Xenos was stretched thin dealing with a gene-stealer outbreak three systems away. We would proceed alone, carrying only our faith in the Emperor and bolters loaded with consecrated ammunition. The journey through the warp proved unusually turbulent. Navigator Horace Malkin struggled to maintain our course, his augmetic eye implants bleeding during the final approach. Brother Librarian Castiel experienced the first of his visions during transit, nightmares of crimson rain falling upon black sand, of ancient stone monoliths that pulsed with sickly green light. At the time, we attributed these disturbances to the unpredictable nature of warp travel. I know better now. Our emergence into real space above Tenebris 6 coincided with the ambush. Three Drukhari vessels materialized from behind the planet's largest moon, their sleek blade-like profiles unmistakable against the void. Their attack was precise and coordinated, suggesting they had anticipated our arrival. How they knew we were coming remains one of many unanswered questions. The Oath of Vengeance shuddered under concentrated Dark Lance fire. Void shields collapsed within minutes. Captain Tiberius ordered immediate combat deployment while our ship's remaining weapons returned fire. The plan was to make planetfall in our drop pods while the cruiser created a diversion, then establish a defensible position until reinforcements could be requested. I remember the violent descent through Tenebris 6's upper atmosphere, the drop pod's metal skin glowing cherry red from friction. Targeting systems malfunctioned during the final approach, scattering our forces across a 20-kilometer stretch of hostile terrain. My pod crashed through the canopy of massive fungal growths that passed for trees on this emperor-forsaken world, the impact throwing me against my restraint harness with enough force to crack two secondary hearts. The planet's surface presented an immediate threat. Tenebris 6 earned its classification as a death world through an ecosystem seemingly designed to eliminate all forms of life not native to its biosphere. The air itself carried toxic spores that would have dissolved unaugmented human lungs within minutes. Even with our power armor's filtration systems operating at maximum capacity, Brother Apothecary Memnon warned against extended exposure. Massive fungal forests dominated the landscape, their caps stretching hundreds of meters into the perpetually overcast sky. Bioluminescent lichen clung to their trunks, providing the only illumination in the permanent twilight created by the planet's distant sun and thick atmospheric cover. The ground beneath our boots squelched with each step, composed of a semi-solid mixture of decomposing matter and writhing parasitic organisms. Our Vox units functioned initially, allowing scattered squads to coordinate a rendezvous at tactical squad Herodian's landing site. 17 battle brothers assembled there, less than half our deployed force. Captain Tiberius was not among them. Brother Sergeant Herodian assumed temporary command, organizing reconnaissance parties to locate our missing brothers and establish a defensible perimeter. The first casualties occurred within hours of landfall. Brother Antonius ventured too close to what appeared to be a flowering plant, only to be ensnared by lightning-fast tendrils that punctured his armor at the joints. The carnivorous flora pumped digestive enzymes into his bloodstream before we could cut him free. He died in agony as the corrosive compounds dissolved him from within, his gene seed too contaminated for apothecary Memnon to harvest. Brother Castile's condition deteriorated rapidly in the planet's environment. The librarian's psychic sensitivity made him particularly vulnerable to whatever malign influence permeated Tenebris 6. He described sensing millions of slumbering minds beneath the planet's surface, ancient consciousnesses stirring from eons of dormancy. His auguries led us eastward, toward a mountain range barely visible through the toxic mist that clung to the valley floor. The discovery of the Xeno's ruins occurred on the third day after landfall. We found the structure half buried in the side of a steep ravine, its entrance revealed by a recent landslide. The architecture defied conventional understanding, geometric patterns that seemed to shift when viewed from different angles, surfaces composed of a metallic substance that absorbed light rather than reflecting it. Most disturbing were the symbols etched into the doorway, identical to glyphs found in confirmed Necron tomb complexes across the galaxy. Brother Tecmarin Gaius noted that the structure's age predated imperial records by millions of years, possibly dating back to the war in heaven itself. The implications were clear. We had stumbled upon either a Necron tomb world or a site connected to their ancient enemies, the Old Ones. Neither possibility promised survival. Our attempts to establish communication with the Oath of Vengeance failed completely by the fourth day. The Vox network deteriorated progressively, first losing ship to surface capabilities, then long-range squad communications, until only short-range transmissions remained functional. The electronic interference pattern matched no known technology in the Adeptus Mechanicus databases. Brother Gaius theorized that the entire planet might be surrounded by some form of disruption field, activated either by our arrival or by the Drukhari attack. We located three more drop pods during our eastward march, all empty save for signs of violence, blood smears, bolt shell casings, and in one case, a chainsword embedded in the pod's interior wall. Of our battle brothers, we found no trace. The few corpses we did recover showed signs of hasty field surgery. Their progenit glands had been removed, though not with the precision expected of Apothecary Memnon's work. The first evidence of biological contamination appeared when Brother Demetrius collapsed during a routine patrol. His armor's auto-senses registered a massive spike in body temperature, followed by neurological abnormalities consistent with extreme pain. When Apothecary Memnon removed Demetrius's helmet, we witnessed the first stages of the transformation, blood vessels beneath the skin turning black, eyes clouding with a greenish film, facial structure beginning to elongate in a manner reminiscent of Xeno's physiology. Memnon's examination of the fallen revealed the most disturbing discovery yet. The progenit glands of our dead brothers showed signs of accelerated mutation. The sacred organs designed to preserve our chapter's future were being rewritten at the cellular level by some unknown pathogen or energy field. The implications were heretical. Something on this planet could corrupt gene seed, the very foundation of the Adeptus Astartes. Brother Castile's final vision came during our exploration of a second Xeno structure, this one fully exposed on a rocky plateau. The librarian dropped to his knees, psychic energy crackling around his armor as blood poured from his eyes and ears. His final coherent warning referenced the Pariah Nexus and Soulless One's awakening. Within moments, his body began to convulse, his psychic hood overloading in a shower of sparks. The explosion of psychic energy that followed killed brothers Thaddeus and Marius instantly, their bodies turning to ash inside their armor. The attack that followed Castile's death emerged from beneath the plateau itself. The ground split open along previously invisible seams, revealing a vast chamber below. Green light spilled upward, casting our shadows in stark relief against the toxic mist. What rose from that abyss matched no Necron pattern recognized in Imperial taxonomies, skeletal forms composed of living metal, but altered, hybridized with organic components that pulsed and shifted beneath their metallic skin. Brother Sergeant Herodian ordered an immediate fighting retreat. We fired as we withdrew, bolter rounds pinging harmlessly off living metal bodies. Brother Gaius deployed a rad grenade that temporarily disrupted their advance, buying precious minutes for our escape. Only 9 battle brothers remained at this point, our ammunition reserves critically low, medical supplies exhausted. The following days blur together in my memory. We moved constantly, avoiding the hunting parties that emerged from previously hidden entrances across the region. Apothecary Memnon succumbed to the same affliction that had taken Brother Demetrius, his transformation accelerated by exposure to the infected gene seed he had been studying. Brother Sergeant Herodian made the necessary decision, granting the Emperor's mercy with his plasma pistol. One by one, my brothers fell, some to the hostile environment, others to the strange, hybridized Necrons that pursued us relentlessly. A few suffered the fate that I now know awaits me, their bodies and minds corrupted by Tenebris Six's influence. I watched as proud space marines, warriors who had faced the worst horrors of the galaxy without flinching, begged for death as their flesh betrayed them. In the end, only I remained, sheltering in the wreckage of our primary drop pod, surrounded by the armor of fallen brothers. The changes had begun in me as well, subtle at first, a darkening of the blood vessels in my arms, a growing sensitivity to light, strange dreams of mechanical precision and cold immortality. My bolt pistol contained a single round, reserved for the moment when transformation became inevitable. That was when I discovered the recorder, still functional despite the damage to the pod systems. With trembling hands, I activated it, determined that some record of the Crimson Sentinel's fate would survive, even if we did not. The Emperor may have forgotten his sons on Tenebris Six, but I would ensure the Imperium remembered our sacrifice. The changes accelerate within me now. Time grows short. I must continue my account while consciousness remains my own. The ruins we discovered became our sanctuary and our prison. After recording my initial account, I led the 8 remaining battle brothers deeper into the ancient structure. Captain Thaddeus had appeared on our 6th day planet side, emerging from the fungal forest with his armor scorched and his left pauldron missing. His arrival restored a fragile chain of command to our dwindling numbers. The captain's eyes held a haunted quality that I recognized all too well. He had witnessed something that had shaken even his transhuman resolve. The structure's interior defied conventional architecture. Corridors bent at impossible angles, chambers appeared larger inside than their external dimensions suggested, and the walls themselves seemed to absorb sound rather than echo it. Brother Gaius identified the construction as neither fully Necronter nor Eldari, but rather something that incorporated elements of both ancient technologies. This hybrid nature should have been our first warning. We established a defensive perimeter in what appeared to be a central chamber, using fallen masonry to create choke points at each entrance. The chamber's ceiling rose nearly 30 meters above us, dominated by a crystalline apparatus that hung suspended without visible means of support. The device emitted a soft, pulsing glow that shifted between emerald and amethyst hues at irregular intervals. Brother Gaius was immediately drawn to it, his mechadendrites extending upward as if reaching for forbidden knowledge. The archaeotech devices throughout the ruins began to activate in our presence. Panels slid open in walls we had previously believed solid, revealing ancient machinery covered in a film of oily residue that resembled liquid mercury, but behaved like a semi-sentient organism. The liquid recoiled from direct contact, yet seemed to follow our movements when we weren't looking directly at it. Brother Gaius collected samples despite my objections, storing the substance in sealed containers for analysis. Our first night in the ruins brought the whispers. They started as barely perceptible sounds at the edge of hearing, too structured to be wind, too rhythmic to be random noise. Brother Malachi was the first to admit hearing them, describing the sensation as similar to having someone speak directly behind his helmet. The voices spoke in no recognizable language, yet somehow conveyed meaning, promises of power, of escape, of survival at costs unnamed. By the 3rd day in the ruins, the barrier between real space and the warp had thinned noticeably. The evidence was undeniable. Shadows moved independently of their casters. Objects left unattended would be discovered meters from their original positions. Most disturbing were the apparitions, translucent figures that resembled our fallen battle brothers in perfect detail, down to the damage on their armor and the wounds that had claimed them. I saw Brother Antonia standing watch at a corridor I knew to be empty. His form wavered like heat distortion above promethium flames, the tendrils of the carnivorous plant still visibly embedded in his armor joints. When I approached, his helmet turned toward me, revealing nothing but swirling darkness where his face should have been. The apparition dissolved when I raised my bolt pistol, but the incident left my hands trembling for hours afterward. Captain Thaddeus witnessed similar phenomena. His rationality deteriorated rapidly after encountering what he described as the ghost of his former mentor, Chapter Master Vortigern, who had fallen during the Damocles Gulf Crusade decades earlier. The captain began holding one-sided conversations with empty air, issuing orders to battle brothers long dead, and spending hours staring at blank walls as if they contained strategic information vital to our survival. Our librarian, Brother Epistolary Morrow, attempted to shield our minds from these warp intrusions. His efforts proved temporarily effective, creating a bubble of relative stability within which we could rest without the constant whispers. This respite was short-lived. On the fifth day in the ruins, Morrow's psychic wards collapsed during what appeared to be a targeted attack from beyond the veil. The librarian fell to his knees, blood streaming from his eyes as he warned of predatory entities circling our position, drawn by our soul's light in the Empyrean darkness. Captain Thaddeus's paranoia reached its breaking point when Morrow's powers manifested visibly during a particularly intense psychic assault. The blue glow of the librarian's defensive aura took on a greenish tinge that matched the crystalline device above us. Thaddeus interpreted this as evidence of corruption. The captain invoked his authority and declared Morrow compromised by warp contamination. Despite my objections and those of Brother Apothecary Severus, Thaddeus executed our librarian with a plasma bolt to the head. The psychic backlash from Morrow's death knocked three battle brothers unconscious and caused blood vessels to rupture in my left eye, temporarily blinding me. With our psychic defenses eliminated, the whispers grew louder, more insistent. They spoke in recognizable Gothic now, using the voices of battle brothers we had served alongside for decades. The apparitions became more substantial, interacting with the environment in subtle ways, leaving footprints in the dust, creating cold spots that registered on our armor's thermal sensors, even moving small objects when they believed themselves unobserved. Brother Gaius devoted himself to repairing our Vox caster, convinced that if we could establish communication with any Imperial forces in the system, rescue might still be possible. His efforts produced results that defied explanation. The devices he constructed or modified invariably broadcast only screams and whispers, regardless of input. His final attempt resulted in a makeshift Vox unit that transmitted what sounded like a human heartbeat, interspersed with words in a language none of us recognized, though it raised primal fear in all who heard it. The discovery of the sealed vault occurred during an exploratory mission to map the eastern wing of the ruins. Brothers Tiberius, Castor, and I discovered a circular chamber whose entrance was blocked by a door of unknown metallic composition. The symbols etched into its surface displayed both the angular precision of Necrontyr script and the flowing curves of Eldari runes, somehow merged into a unified warning. Even without translation, the meaning was clear. Something dangerous lay sealed within. Captain Thaddeus ordered the vault breached despite my recommendation for caution. With our numbers reduced to 6 and our supplies dwindling, he had become fixated on finding weapons or technology that might secure our escape from Tenebris 6. Brother Gaius identified what appeared to be a locking mechanism and set about bypassing it, his mechadendrites interfacing with alien technology in violation of numerous Mechanicus protocols. The vault door opened with surprising ease, sliding silently into recesses within the wall. The chamber beyond contained a single raised dais upon which rested a pyramidal device approximately 1 meter in height. The pyramid was composed of the same metallic substance as the liquid residue found throughout the ruins, but in solid form. Geometric patterns covered its surface, shifting and realigning themselves when viewed from different angles. Brother Tiberius was the first to approach the pyramid. His enhanced transhuman senses detected no radiation, no energy emissions, nothing to suggest danger. When his gauntleted hand made contact with the device's surface, the effect was immediate and catastrophic. The pyramid's apex split open, releasing a blinding column of light that engulfed Tiberius completely. When the light faded seconds later, nothing remained of the battle brother except his boots, still standing upright where he had been. The entity that had been imprisoned within the pyramid remained invisible to normal sight, but its effects manifested immediately. The temperature in the chamber dropped so severely that frost formed on our armor. The whispers that had plagued us for days fell silent, replaced by a pressure in our minds like the weight of an ocean. Captain Thaddeus ordered an immediate withdrawal, but the door sealed itself before we could exit, trapping us with whatever we had released. Brother Castor was the first to fall to the entity's influence. He began clawing at his helmet, screaming about insects burrowing into his skin through his armor joints. When Brother Severus attempted to restrain him, Castor's combat training took over. He drew his combat knife and plunged it through a weak point in Severus's gorget, severing the apothecary's spine. I was forced to end Castor's suffering with a bolt round to his head, but the damage was done. Our medical expertise died with Severus. The entity hunted us methodically through the ruins over the following days. It exploited our mental vulnerabilities with surgical precision, turning strengths into weaknesses and brotherhood into suspicion. Brother Gaius succumbed after hours of hearing machine spirits screaming in his augmetic implants. The Techmarine's enhanced nervous system, designed to interface with technology, became a conduit for the entity to access his mind directly. I found his body in his makeshift workshop, his skull split open from within, mechadendrites still twitching with residual electrical impulses. Our power armor, the legendary protection of the Adeptus Astartes, betrayed us in critical moments. Servo motors locked during combat, auto senses displayed false readings. Life support systems fluctuated wildly, alternating between extreme heat and cold. Brother Coriel's armor sealed itself completely during a patrol, the joints fusing into immobility. He stood paralyzed as the entity manifested partially around him, a shimmer in the air that slowly solidified into crystalline appendages that breached his armor at every joint. His death took hours, and his screams echoed through the ruins long after he should have physically exhausted his capacity to produce sound. Captain Thaddeus and I attempted a final stand in the central chamber, positioning ourselves beneath the hanging crystal device that had first drawn our attention. The captain theorized that the crystal might be restraining the entity's full manifestation, preventing it from taking physical form. His reasoning proved partially correct. The entity's attacks weakened in the crystal's proximity, but this advantage came with a terrible cost. The longer we remained beneath it, the more our own thoughts became transparent to each other and to the entity itself. I learned of Thaddeus's deepest shame through this unwilling communion, his secret relief when Chapter Master Vortigern fell, creating the opportunity for his own advancement. The captain experienced my growing doubt in the Imperium's abandonment of us on this death world. Our exposed vulnerabilities became weapons for the entity to wield against us. It no longer needed to create apparitions or hallucinations, it simply amplified the darkness already within our hearts. Thaddeus turned on me during our third day beneath the crystal. The entity had convinced him that I was not his battle brother, but a warp-spawned doppelganger sent to replace the real Valerius. His attack came without warning, a power sword thrust that would have pierced my primary heart had my armor not malfunctioned in that precise moment, the backpack power unit shorting out and causing me to fall backward. The captain's momentum carried him forward, directly into the space beneath the crystal's center. What happened next defies complete explanation. The crystal pulsed once, blindingly bright, and both Thaddeus and the entity were drawn upward into it. Their forms merged, separated, and merged again in a display that violated physical laws. The captain's screams transcended pain, becoming something closer to ecstasy before cutting off abruptly. The crystal absorbed both completely, its color shifting permanently to a deep crimson that matched our chapter's heraldry. I remained alone in the ruins, the sole survivor of the third company. The whispers had stopped, the apparitions no longer walked the corridors. But the silence brought no comfort, for I knew with terrible certainty that the entity had not been destroyed, merely transformed. It had acquired knowledge of the Adeptus Astartes from Thaddeus's mind, a understanding our strengths and weaknesses in a way no Xeno's threat could naturally possess. The changes in my physiology accelerated after the crystal absorbed Thaddeus. Black veins spread across my skin, and my vision adapted to perceive spectra beyond normal human range. I could see energy patterns flowing through the ruins' walls, connecting to larger networks beneath the planet's surface. My enhanced hearing detected movements kilometers away, the hybridized Necrons still searching, still hunting, but now avoiding the ruins as if they sensed the greater predator that had emerged. By the eighth week, I was the only one left. The entity had claimed each of my battle brothers in increasingly creative ways. Some died screaming, their minds shattered by visions no transhuman psychology was designed to withstand. Others simply stopped functioning, their bodies continuing to move while something essential vanished from behind their eyes. The worst were those who transformed, their flesh and ceramite seeming to blend together into something that resembled neither human nor machine. I survived by embracing blindness and silence. The revelation came after finding Brother Octavius. His body was intact, armor undamaged, but when I removed his helmet, I discovered the horror that had claimed him. His skull remained whole, but his eyes had turned to dust. When I forced his jaw open, I found only desiccated tissue where his brain should have been. Yet his gene seed remained untouched, as if whatever had killed him considered our sacred organs irrelevant to its purpose. That night, as I huddled in a small antechamber with my bolter clutched to my chest, I made the decision that saved me. Using my combat knife, I disabled my armor's external audio receptors, cutting the wires with surgical precision. Next came the visual feed, the targeting systems, and finally, the neural interfaces that connected my black carapace to the power armor itself. I destroyed my helmet's auto senses completely, preferring natural vision to potentially corrupted data. The silence was immediate and absolute. For the first time since landing on Tenebris 6, I could no longer hear the whispers. The constant pressure against my mind eased, not completely, but enough to think clearly. I had effectively sealed myself within a ceramic coffin, but it was a coffin the entity could not easily penetrate. I navigated by touch and memory, my enhanced space marine physiology compensating for the loss of technological assistance. My genetically modified eyes adjusted to the darkness better than any unaugmented humans could, though I kept them closed when possible, relying instead on the subtle vibrations I could feel through my boots and gauntlets. My eidetic memory recalled every corridor and chamber we had mapped, allowing me to move without sight when necessary. Days passed in this self-imposed sensory deprivation. I rationed my nutrient paste, knowing no resupply would come. When thirst became unbearable, I collected moisture that condensed on the ruins' walls, filtering it through a torn piece of my body glove. Sleep came in brief intervals, never more than 20 minutes at a time, the standard combat rest pattern drilled into all Astartes during training. On what I estimated to be the 10th day of my isolation, I felt rather than heard a change in the ruins. Vibrations traveled through the stone floor, rhythmic and deliberate footsteps, but not the heavy tread of power armor. Something lighter moved through the corridors, searching. I pressed myself into a narrow crevice, controlling my breathing as the unknown entity passed within meters of my position. The truth about our enemy revealed itself when I finally risked opening my eyes. The creature moved like liquid metal, its form constantly shifting between humanoid and something utterly alien. Its surface reflected no light, instead seeming to consume it, creating a moving void in the shape of a being. Most disturbing were the faces that occasionally formed on its surface. I recognized brothers Thaddeus, Gaius, and Severus among dozens of others I did not know, their expressions frozen in eternal agony. I recognized what we faced from ancient texts studied during my induction into the chapter's veteran company. This was no demon of the warp, no Xeno's breed cataloged by the Ordo Xenos. We had encountered a Catan shard specifically, a fragment of the entity once worshipped by the Necronter as the Forgotten Harvester. Unlike its better known kin who consumed stars or souls, this particular Catan fed on memories and experiences, leaving its victims physically intact but mentally obliterated. The evidence supported this conclusion. The Necron-Eldari hybrid architecture suddenly made sense. This facility was not a tomb but a prison, constructed during the ancient war in heaven to contain this fragment of a star god. The pyramidal device we had discovered was its cell, the crystalline apparatus, its warden. By breaching the vault, we had freed an entity that had been imprisoned for millions of years, its hunger for consciousness only intensified by its long captivity. The realization brought no comfort, only a clearer understanding of our doom. No force available to a stranded Astartes company could hope to defeat even a shard of a Catan. Our only option had been to flee, and that opportunity had long since passed. Now, alone and with dwindling supplies, I could only hope to deny the entity its feast for as long as possible. I formulated my final plan while hiding in what had once been Brother Gaius's workshop. The Tech Marine had left behind a cache of explosives, Melta charges powerful enough to collapse significant portions of the ruins. If I could not destroy the Catan shard, perhaps I could reseal it, burying it beneath tons of ancient stone until some other unfortunate souls released it in the distant future. Setting the charges required me to move through the ruins more actively than I had in weeks. I placed explosives at key structural points, rigging them to a single detonator. The task took 3 days, during which I glimpsed the Catan shard multiple times, always at a distance, always seeming to search for something specific rather than hunting randomly. On the final day, as I placed the last charge near the central chamber where the crystalline apparatus hung, I became aware of new presences in the ruins. They moved with impossible grace, leaving no footprints, making no sound I could detect even when I briefly reactivated my audio receptors. Yet I knew they were there, watching me, evaluating my actions with ancient intelligence. I caught a glimpse of one, a tall, lithe figure in a suit that shimmered with colors no human language has names for. A mask covered its face, frozen in an expression of mocking laughter that somehow conveyed more sorrow than mirth, an Eldari, but unlike any I had encountered in battle. The diamond pattern of its garb and the ritual weapons it carried marked it as a Harlequin, one of the enigmatic servants of the Laughing God. The Harlequins approached me only after I had set the final charge. Three of them materialized from shadows that should have been too shallow to conceal them, their movements so fluid they seemed to flow rather than walk. The leader carried a staff topped with a crystalline device similar to the one suspended in the central chamber. Though no words were exchanged, their masks never moved, and I had disabled my translation systems along with my other interfaces, communication occurred nonetheless. Images formed in my mind, the Catan shard being drawn into the staff, contained but not destroyed, the ruins collapsing, burying any trace of what had occurred, myself altered in ways I could not fully comprehend, carrying something valuable away from this place. They offered me a choice, though offer implies more freedom than I truly possessed. I could detonate the charges, dying in the explosion but potentially failing to contain the entity, or I could assist them in their ritual of binding and accept the consequences of collaboration with Xenos. The decision came easier than it should have for an Astartes. The hypno-indoctrination that should have made me reject any cooperation with aliens seemed weakened, perhaps eroded by weeks of the Catan's influence. I chose survival not for myself, but for the knowledge I carried. Someone needed to warn the Imperium about what slumbered on Tenebris 6. The ritual commenced immediately. The Harlequins moved in patterns too complex for even my transhuman mind to track, their dance creating a web of light that spread throughout the central chamber. I stood at its center, beneath the crystalline apparatus, holding the staff they had entrusted to me. My role was simple yet crucial. I would serve as bait, drawing the Catan shard to me one final time. The entity came as expected, drawn by the only mind still intact within the ruins. It flowed into the chamber like liquid darkness, faces forming and dissolving across its surface as it approached. I felt its hunger as a physical pressure against my skull, its desire to consume the experiences and memories that made me who I was. Pain beyond description engulfed me as the ritual reached its climax. The staff in my hands grew unbearably hot, burning through my gauntlets to the flesh beneath. The crystalline apparatus above shattered, raining fragments that sliced through my armor. Most agonizing was the psychic assault as the Catan shard fought against its new imprisonment, using my mind as a battlefield. I remember little of what followed. Impressions of movement, of being carried through corridors that shifted and changed. The sensation of void cold against my damaged armor. Voices that spoke in no language I recognized, yet somehow rewrote my understanding of reality with each syllable. I awoke aboard what I initially took to be a vessel of Imperial design, though the architecture seemed wrong, angles too precise, corridors too narrow for power armor. Only later did I realize I was aboard a space hulk, one of the massive conglomerations of ships that drift through the warp. The section I occupied had once been an Imperial cruiser, perhaps centuries ago, but it had been modified extensively with technology no Adeptus Mechanicus adept would sanction. My armor had changed. Xeno's runes covered the ceramite surface, glowing faintly with internal light. The damage had been repaired, but not according to Astartes protocols. Most disturbing was the device embedded in my chest plate, a wraithbone artifact that pulsed in perfect synchronization with my twin hearts, as if it had become a third heart beating between them. My memory contained significant gaps. I recalled my name, my chapter, fragments of our mission to Tenebris 6. But other details eluded me, the faces of battle brothers I had served alongside for decades, the rituals and traditions that had defined my existence as a Crimson Sentinel, even the name of our chapter master. These memories had not been destroyed, but rather, relocated. I could sense them contained within the Wraithbone artifact, accessible but separate from my conscious mind. The Harlequins left me with one final gift, a data crystal containing coordinates and a warning written in perfect High Gothic. The coordinates led to a star system on the edge of the Ghoul Stars, unmarked on any Imperial chart I recognized. The warning was simple yet chilling. The Harvester was but one fragment, the prison weakens, the Noctis Eterna comes. How long I drifted aboard the space hulk, I cannot say with certainty. The chronometers in my armor had been disabled along with its other systems. Judging by the growth of my hair and the healing of my wounds, at least several standard months passed before the Imperial vessel found me. I now record these words from a containment cell aboard the Inquisitorial Black Ship Righteous Judgment. The Ordo Xenos has shown great interest in my account, though I sense skepticism regarding my claims about the Catan Shard. They are particularly interested in the Wraithbone artifact, which their psykers refuse to approach. Tests confirm I remain uncorrupted by chaos, yet the Inquisitor in charge seems reluctant to declare me free of Xeno's taint. I am the last Crimson Sentinel, though records indicate my chapter still exists. Apparently, the Adeptus Administratum has no record of a third company deployment to Tenebris 6. According to official documentation, I have been missing in action for over 40 standard years, presumed lost during a warp transit accident. The Imperium I remember may no longer exist. Fragmentary reports mention a great rift splitting the galaxy, a returned Primarch leading new Astartes warriors, and Necron dynasties awakening in unprecedented numbers. Whether these reports are accurate or further manipulation by the entity I encountered, I cannot determine. What remains certain is my duty. The Wraithbone artifact preserves not only my memories, but those of my fallen brothers, perhaps the last record of what truly happened on Tenebris 6. If the Inquisition deems me untainted, I will request reassignment to the Death Watch. There, my experience with the Forgotten Harvester might prove valuable in the endless war against the Xenos. And if they determine I must be purged, I have made arrangements for this record to reach the Crimson Sentinel's Fortress Monastery. My brothers deserve to know the fate of their lost company, and the Imperium must be warned about what waits in the darkness between stars, ancient gods who hunger not for worship, but for the very essence of consciousness itself. I am Brother Valerius, the last of the Emperor's forgotten sons. While I draw breath, I shall bear witness. When I fall, let my warning endure. The Forgotten Harvester may be contained, but it is not alone, and the prison, like all prisons built by mortal hands, will eventually fail. Thank you.